Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, President Trump makes a campaign stop in the battleground state of Wisconsin.
November 5th is going to be called something else. You know what it's going to be called? Christian Visibility Day, when Christians turn out in numbers that nobody has ever seen before.
He also joined me on my morning show on Thursday.
The whole world is blowing up with this idiot president we have. He's an idiot. What he's done at the border with allowing probably 15 million people by this time into our country and plenty more coming, it's just insane.
We will also hear from retired Admiral James Stavridis on Israel's war against Hamas, including the unintentional killing of aid workers in Gaza and the killing of Iranian guard generals in Syria.
This is the two faces of war.
We've got all this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more over at hughhewitt.com and follow me, please, on X at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. Town Hall Review is part of the Salem Podcast Network. We're going to start with the race for the White House. Who's going to take the oath of office as President of the United States on Inauguration Day, Monday, January 20th, 2025? I can't think of something more consequential for the next decade, or two or three, of our nation than this choice. The polling average over at Real Clear Politics says Donald Trump up by 0.8 of a point. So Trump is up, narrowly, but the former president is up. On Tuesday this past week, Trump paid a visit to Green Bay, Wisconsin.
What the hell was Biden thinking when he declared Easter Sunday to be Trans Visibility Day? Such total disrespect to Christians, and November 5th is going to be called something else. You know what it's going to be called? Christian Visibility Day, when Christians turn out in numbers that nobody has ever seen before. Let's call it Christian Visibility Day, all right? I also met with local law enforcement leaders whose communities are being crushed by Biden migrant crime. You know, we have a new category of crime. It's called migrant crime. It was brought to you by the worst president in the history of our country, Joe Biden, sometimes referred to as Crooked Joe Biden. He's crooked as a $3 bill. In Venezuela, crime is down. I'm sure you're going to be very happy to hear this. Crime is down in Venezuela by 67% because they're taking their gangs and their criminals and depositing them very nicely into the United States. Aren't you happy? Think of it. They're destroying our country. They're destroying, you know, we can drill and we can get the oil going. We can get, but this is a tough one. We're going to end up with the largest deportation in American history. We have no choice.
Then the former president joined me on Thursday morning. I want to begin with Israel, Mr. President, because Sunday marks 6 months since October 7th. And you gave an interview recently to Israel Hayom, which was characterized by many on the left as being critical of Israel. Then Jonathan Tobin writes this morning, wait a minute, that's not right. Trump was the friendliest president ever for Israel. Have you been mischaracterizing your advice to Israel?
Well, you know, with the fake news, you never know what you're going to get. You can say something very plainly, and they'll turn it around. They'll turn around everything. That's why they're fake, and that's why they've been discovered. That's why they've been found to be so, so. You know, if you look at approval ratings, they're lower than Congress now, the news. They used to be in the 90s when I started. And now they're lower than Congress. So I'm very proud of that fact. They're bad news. Look, Israel should have never happened. If I were president, it would not have happened. Iran was broke. They had no money. They had no nothing. And we would have worked to deal with Iran. It would have been made already. In the meantime, they're going to have a nuclear weapon within probably 45 or 60 days. And then it's going to be a little tougher to talk to them. But October 7th would have never happened. They never, ever would have been attacked. But it is what it is, and this horrible thing happened. And what I said very plainly is get it over with and let's get back to peace and stop killing people. And that's a very simple statement. Get it over with. They got to finish what they finish. They have to get it done. Get it over with and get it over with fast because we have to. You have to get back to normalcy and peace. The whole world is blowing up with this idiot president we have. He's an idiot. He's the dumbest president we've ever had. He's the most corrupt, and he's the most incompetent, and he's the worst president we've ever had by a fact. You know, I say, and you've listened to plenty of them, if you add up the 10 worst presidents in history, they haven't done the damage that this guy's done to our country. What he's done at the border with allowing probably 15 million people by this time into our country and plenty more coming, It's just insane. What they have done to our country in 3.5 years is unbelievable.
But you are still standing 100% with Israel. You achieved the Abraham Accords, which was the first peace deal since Sadat. And so are you still 100% with Israel? And what's your advice to Netanyahu beyond get it over with in a hurry?
Well, that's all the advice you can give. I mean, that's the advice. You got to get it over with, and you have to get back to normalcy. And I'm not sure that I'm loving the way they're doing it, because you got to have victory. You have to have a victory. And it's taking a long time. And the other thing is, I hate they put out tapes all the time. Every night they're releasing tapes of a building falling down. They shouldn't be releasing tapes like that. That's why they're losing the PR war. Israel is absolutely losing the PR war.
That's how I read your interview. I read your interview as saying they're losing the PR war. They've got to stop releasing bad video and win the war by going into Rafah.
They're releasing the most heinous, most horrible tapes of buildings falling down. And people are imagining there's a lot of people in those buildings or people in those buildings. And they don't like it. And I don't know why they release wartime shots like that. I guess it makes them look tough. But to me, it doesn't make them look tough. They're losing the PR war, and they're losing it big. But they've got to finish what they started, and they got to finish it fast. And we have to get on with life.
I agree. We got to turn around. Let's turn to politics. First of all, just off the cuff, you gave a line in Wisconsin about Christian Visibility Day on November 5th that had me laughing out loud. Was that in the teleprompter? Was that impromptu? Where'd that come from? Because it was very funny.
No, that wasn't in. That was not in the teleprompter. I was thinking about how insane this was with the Transgender Day on Easter. And now he's going around saying, oh, he didn't know that. He didn't. For 3 days, he knew about it. And now all of a sudden, he didn't know about it. This guy lies. What he lies most about is his golf handicap. Not only is he not a 6, he's not a 36. 36 is the worst handicap you can have before, you know, to qualify. He does not qualify for 36.
Yeah, and, I think I'm in the same category. You never want to play golf with me.
If truckers are in, listen to this. If truckers are in there, he's a trucker. If jet pilots are in there, I flew jet pilots. The guy is just we got to get him out of there. We got to get him out of there.
Besides, now, you have said you'll debate him anywhere, anytime. Do you think he'll agree to any debates?
Anywhere, anytime. I don't think so, but I hope he does.
Do you think
what happened is, you know, that white stuff that they happened to find, which happened to be cocaine in the White House? I don't know. I think something's going on there, because I watched his State of the Union, and he was all jacked up at the beginning. By the end, he was fading fast. There's something going on there. I want a debate, and I think debates with him, at least, should be drug tested. I want
Mr. President, are you suggesting President Biden's using cocaine?
I don't know what he's using, but that was not, hey, he was higher than a kite. And by the way, it was the worst address I've ever seen, State of the Nation. I'll tell you, State of the Union, that's not State of the Union, because he doesn't represent us properly. That I can tell you. But he's obviously, he's being helped some way, because most of the time he looks like he's falling asleep. And all of a sudden he walked up there and did a poor job, but he was all jacked up. I don't think he knows what the hell's happening. He's destroying our country.
There was another migrant murder in Cincinnati this week in a town called Hamilton, where I'm on right now, where you're talking to him right now. 10 million people have come over that border. What are you going to do about that if you're elected president again?
We're going to have the largest deportation effort in history, larger than Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower was very big as a deporter, as you probably know. People don't know that about him. And we're going to have it, because no country can sustain what's happening to us at the border. There is no country ever in history that can sustain it. And we have people coming from jails and mental institutions. We have people coming in as terrorists. You know, if you look at 2019, they actually did a report. There were no terrorists that came in. I don't even believe that. But they have down zero. This is Homeland Security. No terrorists were spotted coming into our country. They had to go through hell with me. And if you look at the map that came out, literally the best day ever for illegal immigrants not coming in was my last week in office, my last days in office. They were the best. Those numbers were down. We had it down. You know, when this guy went to the beach, if he would have just gone to the beach every day and left it alone, we had the border wired. I built 571 miles of wall. I was going to put up another 200 within weeks. You know, it was all manufactured and all set. I had to get the money through the military. I called it an invasion because you couldn't get it through, frankly, some of the Republicans. Now, some of them have now recently endorsed me, like Mitch McConnell. Can you believe that? Mitch McConnell endorsed me. I'm so happy. But Mitch McConnell endorsed me, and John Thune, and Cornyn, and a lot of people endorsed me. That a lot of people said, wow, that's nice. So I must be doing very well. But
polls show that. That's why I called you up for this. Thank you for joining me, Mr. President. Last question. The Afghanistan debacle. Would you take any advice, if you were Israel, from Lloyd Austin, Joe Biden, or anybody connected with that, Tony Blinken, would you take any military advice from them?
No, I wouldn't. I think they're grossly incompetent. You know, I had it set that we were going to get out of Afghanistan with dignity and pride, and we were going to keep Bagram, which now is occupied by China, because it was 1 hour away from where China makes their nuclear weapons. 1 hour, think of it. And it was a massive base. You know, it was one of the biggest runways, most powerful runways anywhere in the world. We gave it up for nothing. We should have kept it, not because of Afghanistan, but because of China. And we should have kept it and didn't do it. But I was all set to get out. I'm the one that got it down to 2,500 troops, and we were going nicely. And we would have been out on the same schedule ahead of him, I believe, even, but with dignity and strength. And this is what happened. When we got out so badly, he moved the soldiers out first. You move the soldiers out last. A child would know that. I wouldn't listen to them. I wouldn't take any instruction from them. Israel knows what they're doing. To listen to these people, what they've done in not only Afghanistan, but I actually happen to think Afghanistan was the lowest point in the history of our country. I don't think there's ever been a more embarrassing moment in the history of our country than what happened in Afghanistan. Between losing $85 billion worth of equipment, 13 great soldiers, who I know the families and the parents of every one of them. By the way, nobody talks about this. 38 soldiers that were decimated with the arms and the legs and the face. 38. Nobody ever mentions them. And leaving hundreds of people behind. We don't even know what number, but we have a lot of people that are probably going to turn out to be hostages at a certain moment. No, this was the worst, most embarrassing moment in history. And if that didn't happen, I don't believe that Russia would have gone into Ukraine. I even think it had an impact on October 7th.
But I think you're right.
With me as president, would have never gone into it. 100% sure, and even Democrats admit that, Putin never would have gone into Ukraine if I were president.
Coming up, war in Israel.
This is the two faces of war. You think of the Roman god Janus, whose two faces, peace and war.
Retired Admiral James Stavridis, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Stay with us.
This is Dennis Prager, and now a truly exciting new benefit. My monthly online video get-together for Pragertopia Plus members only. For an hour each month, get an exclusive chance to ask me anything. I'll be answering your questions. I've never done this. Submit your questions for me at Pragertopia.com. This is our chance to connect like never before. Go to Pragertopia.com or click the banner at DennisPrager.com.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Israel this past week saw two major developments in its ongoing war against Hamas. On Monday, Iran claimed that Israeli airstrikes killed two leading commanders in the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And that same day, an errant strike by Israel killed seven aid workers in Gaza. I turn to a veteran of war, the retired Admiral James Stavridis, former Allied Supreme Commander of NATO. Because we've had two overnight, two big strikes. Israel struck the Iranian embassy in Syria, killing at least two IRGC generals and five other senior staffers who had been plotting with Hezbollah and maybe Hamas. And then seven aid workers were killed in what is probably an IDF errant strike last night. Can you explain to us how such strikes can happen both intentionally with such precision and unintentionally with such damage to Israel's reputation, though it's a war and everyone understands that?
Yeah, this is the two faces of war. You think of the Roman god Janus, whose two faces, peace and war. Here you have an entirely evil and malevolent gathering of high-level terrorists, and I would include the Iranians, Hamas, Hezbollah, all floating around that embassy in Damascus, which has become kind of the planning central for Hezbollah, Hamas. I'm sure they discussed the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea. So malevolent, evil, and clearly directed strike that took out a very high-level IRGC, someone who had every intention of furthering the terror attacks against the state of Israel. My view, a legitimate strike. On the other hand, here you have food aid workers from World Central Kitchen, directed by Jose Andres, one of the true great humanitarians of our time. This is an organization that is trying its best to get food into Gaza. I'm certain what happened is that that tiny convoy, I think it was only two vehicles, probably mistakenly identified as a movement of a high-level Hamas, probably based on intercepts, cell phones. The targeteers did everything they could, I'm sure, to avoid collateral damage. But at the end of the day, the strike occurred, I'm sure, because Israel believed that there was yet another malevolent actor. But it's a moment of classic irony on the battlefield. The bad guys take a shot, and the good guys, in this case, the aid workers, get shot.
I'll come back to the bad guys in a second. You just used a term of art, targeteer. Who are they? Who are the targeteers?
Yeah, these are very high level, typically Navy captains or Air Force colonels who are themselves aviators, who have typically conducted many of these missions themselves. They get pulled up to higher headquarters to analyze every single target release. And the campaign in my mind here is one that I directed, the campaign in Libya, 2011, which was directed by the United Nations to go after the forces of Muammar Gaddafi. The targeteers are small group operators. They are aided by typically a judge advocate general who examines all this. Often you have individuals who have experience on the ground, shall we say, intelligence operatives. I'll leave it at that. And they look at each strike in excruciating detail. This is not World War II bombing campaigns where thousands of bombs are being dropped in a single day. This is looking at the precision-guided strikes. The targeteers are the ones who make the recommendation to the commander whether to take a shot or not.
All right, so now we're talking about targeteers, and we're talking about the ones who decided we're going to hit the Iranian embassy. And that's a big step, Admiral. Can you unpack the significance of that for us? Because embassies are sovereign territory. That means Israel struck Iran yesterday.
Absolutely. And I think that that was a strike that undoubtedly had to be approved by the prime minister, certainly by the minister of defense, probably by the entire war cabinet. It is absolutely an act of war. The reason the Israelis would get to that moment and decide to take that strike is pretty obvious, and that's that they're already de facto in a war with Iran, which has again and again and again stated that their primal desire is to destroy the state of Israel and kill every Jew in the world. So if you're on the receiving end of that kind of war mentality, I think it is not a hard step to get to the point of taking out a very high-level leader. Final thought, this was not like striking the Chinese embassy. You gave that example a moment ago, which was a mistake by the United States. We didn't intend to do that. This was, by all accounts, a deliberate strike. And I think it stands and is legitimate under the laws of war.
When you were running the Libya campaign, did you have any errant strikes?
We did not have anything that approaches the level of what tragically occurred yesterday with the aid workers being killed, or frankly, the United States. You may remember, Hugh, during the debacle of a withdrawal from Afghanistan,
oh, yes.
We took out a father and his family. He was merely trying to get some water to his family. We thought it was a bomb maker. The United States took that shot. These tragedies happen. During the campaign in Libya, I can't recall one, but we dropped probably 25,000 precision-guided strikes. I'm sure they weren't perfect, but I can assure you of this. Every single strike that we made was vetted, approved at least a three-star level by the Joint Task Force commander, a Canadian lieutenant general, don't forget, NATO operation, and was backed up by American targeteers, the best in the world.
All right, now let me turn to what this means going forward. Iran is functionally at war with Israel because Hezbollah is Iran, Iran is Hezbollah. The same is not true about Hamas, though it's almost true. But Hezbollah is Iran, and they're Shia, and they have been shooting at and killing Israeli civilians and Israeli IDF forces for a long period of time. If this gets hot on the northern border, and it's already hot, if it goes to full-scale conflict on the northern border of Israel, do you expect the Israelis to hit Iran?
Not initially. I think that if the Iranians unleash Hezbollah, as you well know, they have over 100,000 surface-to-surface missiles that pose a truly existential threat to Israel. If Hezbollah moved toward a massive set of attacks, Israel would begin by responding and taking out much of that targeting and missile structure in Lebanon. However, if the Hezbollah landed strikes, major ones against big Israeli cities, think Tel Aviv, Haifa, perhaps Jerusalem itself, in that case, I think Israel would strongly consider going after Iran itself. Let's hope we don't get there, because down that path is a much wider war and almost certain U.S. involvement.
Coming up, President Biden presses EVs on the trucking industry.
So this whole ideology of EVs comes from the idea that we need to be monitored, controlled, or we will create a climate catastrophe, and we're too stupid to live our own lives, that we need credentialed experts who are going to manage and give us permission-based society on every aspect of our lives.
When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. On Good Friday, President Biden's EPA released a new electric truck mandate. It will require electric models of trucks to make up 60% of new deliveries in urban areas by 2032. It's similar to what the administration was pressing for passenger cars, except, in the words of the Wall Street Journal, quote, "The truck mandate is even more costly and fanciful." We'll turn first to Mark Morano of Climate Depot. He was a guest of Joe Piscopo.
This EV transition, they're doubling down on everything you've proven that is wrong about electric cars. Cobalt, slavery, lithium, the dumping of the batteries failing, no charging stations. Why does they keep, who's dictating all of this, Mark, do you think?
This is a corporate government collusion coming from an ideology in the United States that's been around for over 100 years, the administrative state, where every aspect of our lives is going to be turned into what they call the permission state, where if you want to have a hamburger, that's going to be monitored, calculated, and determine whether you can, how many you can have, if you can have it at all, or whether you should eat bugs. If you want to drive a gas-powered cars, that's going to be monitored, surveyed. It's going to be part of your carbon footprint. We have CNN a few months ago, at the end of 2023, proposing in a feature article on CNN's website, carbon passports for travel to monitor how much we travel. So this whole ideology of EVs comes from the idea that we need to be monitored, controlled, or we will create a climate catastrophe, and we're too stupid to live our own lives, that we need credentialed experts who are going to manage and give us permission-based society on every aspect of our lives. That's all this is. And they're affecting our freedom of movement, and that's what the whole EV transition, so to speak, is about. It's easier to transition your gender than it is to transition our energy and our transportation the way they're trying to do this.
And they may, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, to your point, they, like in London, I mean, we hear that they really want to put certain times you can go out. They'll give you limits on when you could go out, if you can use your car. And they're putting, and correct me if I'm wrong again, cameras, you know, to track you. I mean, could it possibly get that bad?
Well, that's what this, you know, what happened with the Biden administration to the highway transportation agency. Tried to make it so states were going to be compelled to monitor car use and your travel and then your emissions. And they're also doing this with the Securities Exchange Commission, with companies and business. Wow. Now, keep in mind, it always starts voluntary. Oh, you don't have to do this.
Yeah,
the first year, but you can damn sure the second, third, and fourth, it's going to be mandated. And the idea is they want to monitor, surveil you, and then they, once they have all the data on you, then they start tightening the noose. And that's what they're trying to do. So all EVs are just that, just one little string of this massive, giant fur ball that they're trying to throw at us here.
It seems like in this, like what's happening in America now, it's like they have the, it's going to be the elite and then the rest of us. There's no middle class. But the big rich people are going to have their planes, do whatever they want, and then the rest of us are just like sheep minions. I mean, that can't sustain, though, Mark Morano, correct?
Well, not throughout history. This is what, you know, it was Milton Friedman, the economist, and he said this back in the late 90s. He said, throughout history, the United States, the last 150 years or so, has been in a rare exception in history where we had freedom of movement, liberty. The rest of history has been misery, tyranny, and oppression. We are in just a little blip in history, and we think it's going to go on forever. It only goes on forever if we recognize, fight it at every step. Our greatest failing as a people, Joe, was March of 2020, when we accepted the Chinese model that the World Health said, follow China. If you want to stop a virus, copy China. And we all, like lemmings, the entire Western world jumped off. Once that happened, game changer. This is the world in which we live since March of 2020. That's what I argue in my book, The Great Reset. Everything changed March of 2020 because all these politicians realized, you know, whether it be New York governor or California governor, they could declare a COVID emergency and become a dictator overnight. And they don't want to relinquish that power. We have the central bank digital currency coming down the pipe, which Joe Biden's pushing now. And the Bank of England said the quiet part out loud. It will allow the government to limit your spending to what they deem sensible. So you want to buy a hamburger, a firearm, you want to drive your car, you're going to have very strict limits if you're allowed to do it at all in the future.
That and Biden's buying this hook, line, and sinker, correct, Mark Morano? He's totally along with these world elitists, these world reset elitists, yes?
Yes, but you know, I saw something that actually made a lot of sense to me. We shouldn't actually refer to Biden as a individual human being. We should just refer to it as the handlers behind the Biden, the man who's the figurehead at the White House, because he's really not directing any of this.
I mean,
he's the perfect president for this whole agenda. He's just sort of like the, you know, just this stuffed animal that they pose up there in different positions when he's not falling. And they can just attribute anything, and they're cranking it all. You know, the real power is said to be, and I don't have expertise in this area, but President Obama, who actually lives not far from the White House, stayed in D.C., and a lot of his administration, they're really pulling the strings here behind the Biden administration. It's Obama's third term.
Coming up, climate and energy, the case for realism.
What we need is policymakers to realize But adaptation makes much better sense than mitigation being trying to slow the warming.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
John Solomon provides exclusive reporting and newsmaker interviews on John Solomon Reports on the Salem Podcast Network.
We broke this story because we got the documents early. They put out this new information, and it affirms our reporting that this Democrat donor gave about $5 million or more in assistance to Hunter Biden, basically paid off his bills.
Subscribe to John Solomon Reports today on Apple, Spotify, Google, Rumble, or at SalemPodcastNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. As we look back at the climate agenda from the Biden administration and the growing number of electric vehicle mandates, there's something I see lacking from some of the conversation. Realism. That is, what is the cost of and the real world impact of mitigation? That is, the human effort to reduce emissions. And what is the cost and impact of efforts of adaptation to this change in the environment? Realism is what Cal Bisner gives us in the book he edited, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. Bisner was a guest on my program. I want to run to just the preface and then to one chapter. In the preface, you make four claims. Anthropogenic global warming is real, but unlikely to become catastrophic. It could, but won't necessarily be moderated, prevented, or even reversed by a new natural cycle of global cooling or augmented by a new warming cycle. Three, the cost-benefit ratio of adapting to whatever future climate we face is better than mitigation. And four, if we choose adaptation over mitigation, life after climate change will most likely be better than it is today or ever has been. Amen, 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 amen. I'm so glad you put this at the beginning of the book, Calvin. How did you come to those four conclusions?
Well, you know, I could just say I get it from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And that would shock a lot of people. But the fact is that this body from the UN told us in 2018 in a special report on global warming of 1.5 degrees that if we did nothing to slow global warming from now to the end of the century, that warming would reduce global world product at the end of the century by about 2.6%. Now, that might sound bad, except that we also know that between now and then, gross world product will expand to probably just short of 9 times what it is today.
And I would recommend it to every author out there. If you want people to read your book, give them pre-notes. The chapters, example, the role of the sun, the role of the ocean, the role of evaporation, precipitation, and clouds, the role of greenhouse gases, the holy grail of climate change, quantifying climate sensitivity. That would, like, normally drive me off. But if someone will explain it to me, and I don't even know what quantifying means, and I'm a politics major. I'm not supposed to know this stuff. So kudos on this.
Well, thanks very much. I think it's going to make the book very, very helpful. Our real hope is that this book is going to get into the hands of lots and lots of policymakers. And people keep saying, trust the science. Well, I'm sorry, that's not scientific. Science, real science, always says, trust but verify. Or, to speak as a Christian, 1 Thessalonians 5:21 says, test all things, hold fast what is good. That's the basis of scientific method. And so what we've done in this book is, by putting the chapter summaries at the start in very simple, clear language, people can understand. And then by reading through the chapter, they can get a grasp of how we came to those conclusions. The more complex reasoning makes better sense since they've already had a sort of an on-ramp to it. But the fact is that policymakers are mostly not scientists. And so if they're going to grasp these things, they need to have something that puts things in popular language, in layman's language, and yet that also has the solid scientific and economic and engineering and, frankly, also ethical foundations for what would be good policy, which basically means we do far more in order to adapt, because we can, you know, frankly, if you have income equivalent to the bottom, say, 5% of Americans, you can thrive in any climate from the Arctic Circle to the Sahara Desert to the Brazilian rainforest. But if you're trying to get along on about $1 or $2 a day, You can't thrive in the best tropical paradise. And so what we need is policymakers to realize that adaptation makes much better sense than mitigation, mitigation being trying to slow the warming. The cost-benefit analysis on that is just horrible.
Let me ask you about Miami in particular. And here's the background, Dr. Beisner, on this. I have done two presidential debates in Miami, one in 2016, one this past November. Both times, my friends in legacy media, and they're all left-wingers on both CNN and NBC, wanted to ask about climate change. And I said, guys, gals, if we do that, I know what the Republicans are going to say. And then they all said, but Miami's going to be underwater. We got to ask about Miami being underwater. I said, no, it's not. It's not going to be underwater. Nobody invests that kind of money. You should see Miami, right? Like, it's a $1 billion construction site. Nobody makes rational investments in areas that are going to go underwater. How do you deal with people like this? How do you punch through this wall of ignorance in the media?
Well, unfortunately, you have to look at some facts. And even the UN IPCC says that there has been no significant acceleration in the rate of sea level rise over the period of allegedly man-made global warming. I used to live right near Miami, about 15 miles from the coast, 8 feet above sea level. And so I did a check. I went to the IPCC's estimate of how much warming would drive up sea level. And I discovered that according to its estimates, I would have beachfront property in about 3,600 years. That kind of disappointed me. I thought I'd get rich, you know? But it didn't happen.
Well, let me extend it. I also have Admiral Stavridis on once a week. And he said, look, I sailed places I couldn't sail at the start of my career, at the end of my career, because the water is warmer. I go to Maine in the summer. My brother-in-law's lived there forever. And the people in Maine say the lobsters are slowly moving north because it's getting warmer in the ocean. And I don't think that's debatable. At the same time, I don't think it's catastrophic. No. Is that the bottom line of climate and energy, your book, that change is happening and it's not catastrophic and we can adapt? And if you want, mitigate, but mitigate really
right.
doesn't work.
Right. It's not catastrophic. And actually, you pointed at a good point about this, and that is that greenhouse gas driven warming happens primarily toward the poles in the winter at night, not toward the equator in the summer in the daytime, i.e. low temperatures rise, high temperatures don't much at all. And the result is longer growing seasons, and we can farm farther and farther toward higher latitudes, which makes more food available for everybody. And by the way, all that added CO2 in the atmosphere makes all the plants grow better, which again makes more food for everything that depends on plants, which is basically everything that isn't plants.
I lived in California from 1989 to 2016. California for the last 2 years averaged in Orange County, California for 100 years, 6 inches of rain in the winter. In the last 2 years, it's gone up to 9 inches of rain. And it's going to be more this year, which is great for California. It's a pain in the neck for people who hate rain, but it's great for California. Coming up, the practical impact of global warming.
This is just a tremendous benefit to mankind. History tells us the warmest periods have always been the best.
In the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
Charlie Kirk here. It is critical we keep AM radio in all cars and all trucks. More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio for news, weather, and opinions. AM is also the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping you advised of threatening weather conditions and amber alerts. Text AM to number 52886. Tell Congress that we need AM radio in our cars. Again, text AM to the number 52886. Standard message and data rates may apply.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Realism in the conversation on the environment, but we need a whole lot more of. And I found it both refreshing and accessible, understandable in Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, a new book that you ought to go and get, Climate and Energy. Remember that name. Let's pick up with more of my conversation with Cal Beisner. Has anyone figured out yet that if, in fact, the climate changes to bring more rain to California, it's great news for everybody?
Yeah, that is very, very good news. By the way, though, that's not a long-term trend. I mean, that's called weather.
Rats.
Climate is weather averaged over at least 30 years. And
rats.
Dr. John Christie, who is who is a climate scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville and manages NASA's satellite global temperature monitoring system. John is a native of Central California, and he checked the rainfall records going back to 1895. There has been zero upward trend in rainfall.
Is there an upside about which people are unaware about climate warming?
Oh, absolutely. As I said a moment ago, the warming happens mainly toward the poles, mainly in the winter, mainly at night. So it raises low temperatures. The last freeze in the spring comes earlier. The first freeze in the fall comes later. That allows a longer growing season. You can multi-crop. There are just all kinds of benefits. The added CO2 makes all the plants grow better. There's been a huge increase in leaf area index measured by satellite photography. This is just a tremendous benefit to mankind. History tells us the warmest periods have always been the best.
How much will the oceans rise in the next 30 years?
In the next 30 years? I would guess perhaps 2 inches, because the best figures indicate it's an average of about 1.5 millimeters per year. That figures out to about 7 inches per century. So take, 3/10 of 7 inches.
Okay, so tell me something. Why do people worry about this? I mean, I get all these graphs about how many people live close to the coast, and I'm one of them. But I just can't imagine people can't move back to deal with that kind of a rise. Isn't it just absurd alarmism?
They worry about this because they didn't grow up in Holland. For 600 years, Holland has had most of its land under sea level, and it's done just fine with dikes and the like. It is the world's second biggest exporter of agricultural products. You don't do that with salt water all over your land. So the fact is, we can deal with sea level rise at the slow rate at which it is happening by building seawalls.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. You can get my complete conversation with Cal Beisner at townhallreview.com. If you enjoyed the program and the podcast, do us the favor of sharing it with a friend. Let me point out, you can get this podcast, Town Hall Review, and my own podcast at the SalemPodcastNetwork.com. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin and producers David Bouchon, Alex Perez, Harley Eide, Adam Ramsey, and of course, Dwayne Patterson. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.